Hi and welcome to Hindsight on ABC Radio National Summer. Michelle Rayner with you. Today, the second program in our season of stories about exploration and empire, with a journey into the Australian interior through the extraordinary experience of a young colonial woman, Emily Carolyn Cray. By the mid-19th century, the general shape of Australia's northern coast was well known, but European knowledge of the interior was patchy. And at this time, a number of expeditions into the heart of the continent had starkly and tragically illuminated the risk inherent in venturing beyond the settlements. Think of the expeditions of Ludwig Leichhardt, Augustus Gregory, Burke and Wills, and John McDougall Stewart. Yet colonial governments in Australia in the latter part of the 19th century were hungry for land for development. And it was against this backdrop that in 1883, an unlikely group of four explorers headed west from Normanton in northern Queensland. Their goal was to identify potential grazing land for settlement, as well as a route for a possible rail link between western Queensland and Darwin. The party was made up of expedition leader Ernest Favink, two experienced bushmen, Lindsay Crawford and Harry Cray, and most surprisingly of all, Harry's 22-year-old wife, Emily Carolyn. In the late 1800s, it was extremely unusual for a woman to be part of an expedition. In fact, no European woman had ever ventured into this part of the country. And the story of this expedition has only been remembered because of the personal diary that young Emily Carolyn recorded during the four-month journey into the inland. That diary was recently discovered by another young woman, the Australian landscape artist Gemma Lynch Memory. Hindsight's Ros Bluett spent time with Gemma Lynch Memory in the artist's studio and farm in Tasmania, and began to unfold the story of how these two women's lives were brought together by a chance act across time and place.
I went into a secondhand bookshop and I found the diary, and I was attracted to the cover of it because it had a very strong horizon line, and my paintings have got very strong horizon lines in them, and that was sort of an aesthetic thing. I picked up the diary and started reading it, and before I knew it, I was reading the diary of Australia's first female explorer.
On a farm south of Hobart, Gemma seems a long way from the scenes of desert space and exploration that adorn the walls of her studio. Faintly written across some of the paintings are excerpts from Emily Caroline Cray's 1883 diary, in an entwining of landscape and recollection.
I didn't read history, I read a woman's relationship with the landscape. She talks about the landscape in ways that I could really relate to with the way I paint my paintings. And I just fell in love with what she was describing. And almost instantaneously, I felt I had to paint this. She's told the story through her diary, and I wanted to tell the story again through my paintings.
My grandmother was an amazing woman, really. She was well known for having written her diary. The whole family were in awe of her. They couldn't believe what she had done. Well, I think she believed, and her husband believed, it was her task to write every night exactly what they'd done and where they'd been. Who knows who would have survived towards the end? And they looked upon it as a very important job.
Diana Smith, the youngest daughter of Emily Caroline's eighth child, has inherited the job of custodian of her grandmother's diary transcripts and photographs. Diana has assisted historian and editor Peter Monteith since he discovered the original diary, rather neglected, in Sydney's Mitchell Library.
It is such a rare document in Australian history because it is the diary of a woman explorer. Rare, I think, also because it was a diary which was preserved pretty much as it was written at the time, so that at the end of each day of travel, she would still manage to find the energy to record what had happened during the day. So it's a very raw document of life and exploration at that time.
Saturday, the 14th of April, 1883. 17 horses in all, 9 packed and 4 loose, and the other 4 we, Mr. Favink, Mr. Crawford, Harry and I, were riding. We left the track immediately after crossing the Gregory River and came across an open plain for about 6 miles, travelling very slowly, on account of Mr. Favink having to consult his compass every few minutes.
That's a page of her diary, and if you examine it, it's very consistent. But can you read anything?
Slightly.
Slightly. Now, that's the thing. Well, you actually, if you knew the joins, you could read the lot.
She does running writing, yes, but it's yes. In a very old fashion.
Yes, it's. She learnt this in England at a very nice school. We should call it a well-educated hand, it was, in those days.
Left camp at 8:30 this morning, after having a good deal of trouble finding the horses, but we were up earlier than ever. The moon was still shining brightly. We went through a magnificent gorge. The rocks on either side of us were so immense, and a creek of lovely dark-looking water.
Captivated by Emily Caroline's vivid descriptions, Gemma decided to retrace the 1883 expedition with her husband Terry and 2 others, revisiting the scene she intended to paint. Despite the differences, Emily riding side saddle with a veil to ward off the flies, while Gemma was in a 4-wheel drive with plenty of insect repellent, both women began their journeys on the 14th of April, 124 years apart.
This one is called She Who Explores, and it's very much a celebration of that pioneering aspect of her journey. And this quote, I love this quote, left camp at 8:30 this morning after having a good deal of trouble finding the horses. But we were up earlier than ever, the moon was still shining brightly.
We have only come about 10 miles today, but we had a high stony steep mountain to come up. And the horses were tired, so we only came about 5 miles or so. We none of us ate any salt meat or anything that would tend to give us a thirst. We are now on what is called the tableland, a flat piece of country on the top of a very high mountain. We are now in unexplored country where no white man has been before.
I think that is a quintessential quote from the diary, that we are now in unexplored country where no white man has been before. I think that's amazing. Imagine being able to say that.
She must have had an ink plume, an inkwell. Every page had a blotter through it, which some of them have lost now. When you think that travelling all those hours on horseback, writing this perhaps in a tent in the evening. I think that's probably why some of the entries are fairly short. 22 when she did this. She'd never been to the bush, and yet here she was, exploring.
The group of 4 in 1883 proceeded west from Queensland, traversing over 500 miles of uncharted territory. They were to rely on the navigational skills of Ernest Favink until hopefully reaching the Overland Telegraph Line. Gemma hadn't been this far inland either. Yet with a GPS and a satellite phone, her group was able to pursue their expedition in a more leisurely way.
We took a photographer to record the journey so that when we got back, I could take all these photos back into my studio. And then we also had a writer. And then Terry, my husband, as well. And he was very instrumental in, you know, navigating exactly where we were going to go. And I was really just there, lost in a world of my own, really. I had a whole swag of paints and pencils, and I did a lot of sketches. And I filled a whole journal of preparatory drawings on the journey. So the four of us played our role, as the original four played their own role. We were driving for 1,000 kilometres and we didn't see another person, another car. So as far as that sort of, you know, real isolated Australia, that quintessential Australian outback, crossing those tablelands, and then you realise, whoa, that's another whole world out there.
Yesterday we did about 11 miles. And at 12, we waited by the side of a waterhole while Mr. Favink marked a tree. From the place the tree was marked, we brought the two water bags, full of water, and used them for luncheon, never suspecting we would find a difficulty in getting any more. It is very cold at night now, and Harry and I find two blankets hardly enough to sleep comfortably.
On the one hand, of course, there was this sense of apprehension. How would she cope with the hardships of the travel? But in fact, she coped extremely well with it. She records that it was tough. And yet every day, there she is at the end of the day, recording the day's events in the diary, putting up with the hardship.
We had the curry for breakfast this morning, and I accused Mr. Crawford of leaving the quills and the ducks instead of plucking them clean. Later, however, when it was broad daylight, when I went to empty the remains of the curry out of the billy, I discovered the quills to be thousands of flies, which had evidently blown off the grass when I was making it. The grass everywhere is simply covered with flies. The men, after discovering they had eaten a meal of flies, were all ill.
She just got on with it and she took it all in her stride, and in a quiet way, I think she really looked forward to, you know, what lay ahead.
Left camp at 8 and arrived at camp tonight at 4:30 after a rather an exciting day. We saw numbers of black's tracks, evidently quite freshly made. All the way along there were fires where the black's were. We are in the really dangerous country now. Rode all day with revolvers in our hands in case of an attack from blacks.
There were the dangers of shortage of water, shortage of food. The other great unknown was how the indigenous people would react to the presence of these interlopers. They were very real dangers, and the diary is quite clear about that.
No, she was definitely not a panicky woman. As a matter of fact, she had a great belief in her religion, and I think that would have carried her along. So I think she had faith that things would work out. If not, so be it.
We travelled for some miles along the Port Darwin Road, but left it again at 3. The track was so dusty and so very worn that we were glad to leave it and go into the trackless bush once more. After crossing the Nicholson River, we came to a camp evidently used last night, as there were tracks of a large mob of cattle, and we came up with the mob soon after. The poor horses have great holes under their eyes where the flies have been eating them.
For large parts of it, it's very, very dry. She refers repeatedly to the plague of flies that torments them. So that's very present in the description, but behind that there's a kind of wonderment at the landscape that they traverse every day as well.
The earth is perfectly dry, and it is astonishing where the beautiful clear water comes from. We are still close to the Nicholson.
I spent hours sitting on the banks of the Nicholson River sketching in my diary, and when I looked up, that's what I saw in this piece we're looking at now, the Nicholson River painting. And you can see the original piece here. It's got all of the original organic matter, like all the branches and leaves and sticks, and very impasto thick oil paint, and the very sandy bank of the Nicholson River. And the water there was green, as it is in the painting here.
Describe it all in olive
greens.
Yeah,
olive greens, and as it sinks further into the bottom panel, a muddy, browny green colour. And I might mention in this painting, the sand that you see beneath the tree line, that is sand, the original sand from the banks of the Nicholson River, and it is that salmon pink colour. And it sort of looks perhaps a bit out of context when you see it in the painting, but that's how it was.
Almost directly we left last night's camp, we crossed the Nicholson, one of the largest rivers when full in Australia. It had very little water in it, but it had five or six arms, all of which we crossed, and in the wet season it is one huge river.
And in the wet season, it is one huge river. And I think that bit, it was one huge river, particularly in the larger canvases. When you hang this painting on the wall, it's a really big painting. And those words, it is one huge river, this is one huge painting of one huge river.
It is one huge river.
Yeah, I love that bit.
This is my father's first album with a small Brownie camera. My father was her youngest son. I'm his youngest daughter. Ah, yes, 1919. That's his mother there. That's Emily Caroline Cray, known as Carrie. And she's there, an older woman. Here we are. There she is with my brother, Michael. She loved babies, obviously. She had a lot of babies, and this is her grandson.
She does look very similar to the photograph of her when she was 22, don't you see that?
Yes, she is. There she is. Very hard-working. I think you can see it in her face, but healthy, strong.
She's got very high cheekbones. How would you describe her face?
Strong, solid, and inviting.
At about noon today, we had a very boggy creek to cross. My horse got bogged and fell on its side, and I came over on my back. I was none the worse for my intimate acquaintance with the mud, but rather enjoyed it as a relief from the monotony of the day's ride.
Part of the rationale seems to have been that if women could participate in an expedition like that, then the country couldn't be that dangerous. And the message then would be that more settlers should settle that area. It was safe. It's quite interesting in itself that she embraces this opportunity, even though it means a very difficult journey without any other female company. So there's this kind of toughness or feistiness which informs her attitude to the expedition from the beginning.
Emily Caroline records very few complaints about the harsh conditions and sheer isolation that she must have felt at times. To convey this sense of space, Gemma has divided her paintings into panels. Horizontal lines define the Earth's colours and harsh light, and the separateness of the small group.
This is a three-part work. It's a triptych, and we have Emily in the first panel, Harry in the second panel, and then that gorgeous waterhole image in the third panel.
There's three straight horizon lines, you know, running through each painting, and the paint actually is thick and it stands out.
That's because the landscape isn't flat, you know. There's nothing smooth about the landscape, particularly this stuff that I'm painting, but it is very rocky and very grainy and very sandy. There's a lot of debris in this painting that has actually come from the journey. I collected a lot of soil samples when I was there, and I've used those soil and that sort of the debris that you see in the work, and it having come directly from the ground that we were walking on when we were there, I think it's got a real sense of place.
April 1883. We pass the borders of Queensland at 4:30 and are now in South Australia. The flies still torment the very life out of us from sunrise to dark. The cold nights don't seem to kill them. They come back in millions in the day. No mosquitoes, fortunately. We are now camped by the side of a large, beautiful lagoon, which Mr. Favink has named the Caroline, after me. He is giving all the rivers, etc., names for the South Australian government.
The value of the manuscript was that it was located very much in a specific place and time, so any kind of editing, even of trivial details, is a loss. The key person in that process of identifying a faithful transcription of the original diary as it stood was Diana Smith, the granddaughter of Caroline Cray.
So we live next door as a family to her, and we could interact with her, and my father would go across and check on her and be with her and make a transcript of the diary. My father was very keen to make sure that people knew about the diary, and he knew also that it'd be very hard for other people to understand her writing. It was very difficult. So he'd go over in the evening to translate, really, from what she read of the diary next to him as she lay in bed, and he would write out a transcription, which I've got now, of what she said was in the diary. I noticed that the diary actually differed from the actual transcript. My father edited what she was saying. He put it in better words, maybe, sometimes.
What he thought.
What he thought or what she thought, I'm not sure. But you can see that's when she did the crossing outs for some of the things. You see all this is the original.
So that's when she did the crossing out. She didn't do the crossing out on the journey as such.
No, she did the crossing out now.
So Diana Smith, one of the few able to read Emily Caroline's handwriting, helped editor Peter Monteith reveal the original manuscript. Emily had lightly struck out domestic details, recipes, and grumblings about standards and manners. Yet more defiantly, she'd erased an account of an obviously unpleasant incident that took place between herself and Ernest Favink.
It has been a decided relief to have Favink away. He never appears to get over his sulks.
In the edition that we produce then, we've restored as far as possible those things that she at one point in her life felt that perhaps shouldn't be more widely known.
Thanks to Favink and through him, Crawford is getting disagreeable also. We do not look forward to going out with these two at all. Two pleasant men would make such a difference.
There's an undercurrent of tension with Favink and with Crawford. So the attractive thing is precisely that it's not an official report. It gives both less and more than an official report would give.
Favink is making himself most objectionable. We might have known what to expect from a man who is not a gentleman.
Now you can see she crossed out things, but there are things that she crossed out that you cannot read. I think you could get a laser somehow and read them, and it will tell you exactly why she and Favink fell out.
Personally, I thought she's crossing out all the bits that I'd like to hear about relationships between the people and her opinions about
yes.
people, and I think she...
Well, that's what she did cross out. She didn't want to hurt Favink's wife, I think, because she knew it would be read by a lot of people.
Emily Caroline's diary was in fact read by very few at the time, while Ernest Favink's official expedition diary was widely circulated. Favink went on to write a robust account of 100 years of Australian exploration. Surprisingly, or perhaps not, he omitted all members of the 1883 expedition, except himself. But despite differences creating tensions in the group, all knew that their survival depended on continuing to work together.
As the afternoon advanced and no signs of water, the horses and we were feeling pretty well done. And at about 11, we thought we should be obliged to leave two of them behind. They were so weak and knocked up.
The lack of water was a constant issue right throughout their journey. And as you can see in this muddy waterhole painting here, muddy waterhole number 3, and trying to depict that real hopelessness that they feel about having no water. That very glass-like finish that you see in the original painting here, that gives you a real sense of water, and the juxtaposition of that sitting next to the very dry, earthy, gritty landscape, I feel when I look at it again, gives me a real sense of place of being there in that landscape. This quote comes from Saturday the 5th of May 1883. We were getting almost hopeless when the horses were getting worse and worse, having been 50 hours without water, when Harry, who had been again to see if timber ahead was a creek,
galloped back and told us that if we held the horses, not allowing them to rush, there was enough water in a hole for us and them.
Everything that you read on the work is a direct quote from her diary. This is what she has said about the land when she was looking at it. And what you see beneath it is what I have painted about. So there's a real sort of dichotomy of two people's impressions, one in the written sense and one in the visual sense.
How thankful we were, to be sure. I immediately went on, and I did have a good drink of muddy water. I thought my poor little gypsy would never stop drinking. She and all the horses were perfectly mad. They smelt the water from a distance, and several of them came headlong into the hall and drank until they could scarcely move. I enjoyed the muddy water as much as the clearest.
I love that quote. I think that's really gives you, you know, a feeling of their desperation, of lack of water. And another thing I think is gorgeous about the way she talks about the lack of water, it's not only for the humans that were on the journey, but a real sense of concern for the horses. She talks about Gypsy. I mean, Gypsy is the name of her horse. And you can tell she was so relieved that her horse was enjoying a drink of water, almost as much as she was.
The group's search for water became a continual preoccupation. The other uncertainty was how they'd be perceived by the local Aboriginal people.
This has been a very eventful day. We left camp at 8 this morning, anxious to reach water early. We went on past a dry creek till 2, and almost despairing of getting water, when we saw not 3 miles ahead of us a black's fire, or smoke, rather. So we made for it, knowing there must be water where niggers were. They were a peculiar sight. They had never seen white men before, we soon found out, by their showing no fear when Favink pulled out his revolver.
It is the record of someone who has experienced nothing like this before. A good part of her formative years was spent in England and then in Sydney, and she was still a very young woman at this time. So this exposure to landscape and to the race relations of the far north must have come as quite a shock to her.
Favink tied a man with a strap to prevent his running away before he had led us to water. We were not going to do them any harm. We merely wanted them to take us to water. We signed what we wanted them to do, and they then went on with a great many gesticulations which we suppose meant fright. And after taking us about 3 miles, we came upon the camp and a waterhole. The blacks wear no clothing of any sort. One man had a carpet snake, which he had killed, round his waist, ready to cook for his supper.
If you notice, the niggers came in when she was closer to the telegraph line. Then it referred, it went back to blacks later. But I think the niggers must have been because the others called them niggers. And if you notice also her spelling of a creek, she C-R-E-A-K, until she must have seen it written somewhere, and C-R-E-E-K. And so that shows she didn't know Australia very well at that stage.
She certainly is a woman of her time in the sort of language that she uses. In some ways, I think also, though, there is in her account a greater level of empathy than there is in other accounts. There's one point where she points to that recognition on her behalf, at least, that the Europeans posed a threat, because what they were doing by settling this territory in northern Australia was depriving the indigenous people of the means to support themselves. And she recognises that, and she describes these relations where it's very clear who plays the master role and who plays the servant role.
Not having been arrested by white men, they did not attempt to do us any harm. We gave them some damper and they seemed pleased. We saw several spears and things lying on the ground in their camp, but they would not allow one to take anything away, as harm has been done so often by white men stealing the blacks' only means of gaining their food.
In the diary, she doesn't openly record shock, but I think reading between the lines, it's very clear the extent to which this is extremely confronting for her. The impression we get from the diary is that, yes, there is some contact, but it seems more likely that the Indigenous people are keeping at a distance. They don't perceive this small group as a danger. They probably observe them from a distance. And they, in all probability, were just as fearful of the Europeans as the Europeans were of the Indigenous people. And that's very clear in the diary.
On some of the stations the party passed through, Aboriginal people were working as domestic servants. Emily often accompanied them to the creeks to do washing. The journey also involved waiting. Sometimes it was weeks at a time at various cattle stations along their route. This enabled the men to do short explorations of the surrounding country. Occasionally, and to her delight, Emily would have the company of wives and children of the graziers.
We went for a drive this afternoon, first to see a spring which is most peculiar. Where the spring is a large mound covered all over with pandanus, or corkscrew palms. And in the centre of this mound is a spout of water always running. Just below the spout is a little pond. Then the water runs away in little streams down the mound and along the flat a little way.
When we got to Springvale Station in the Northern Territory, I just walked around the back of this property, and she talks about the water lilies in a beautiful way. And lo and behold, there before me was this pond of the most beautiful water lilies I have ever seen in my life. And they were exactly how she described them.
The leaves are immense round things, larger than the largest washhand basin, and the flowers are large dark pink. They look lovely all over the water.
The lily pads were as big as washhand basins, and the pinks were so pink, and they were so beautiful. And that was a real highlight of the journey for me in the celebration of our landscape. I mean, here's this, in the middle of nowhere, like an oasis really, is this place that contains this pond full of these most beautiful water lilies. And I love those paintings, and I love painting those paintings.
The Overland Telegraph line, completed 10 years earlier, had brought the colony of South Australia and its northern extension together, connecting the continent with the rest of the world. Stations were erected along the route to repair and service the line. These rudimentary outposts were lifesavers for travellers and expedition parties that ventured into the centre. And Favink's group was no exception. The two telegraph masters in charge of the Powell Creek station rarely saw new faces, and consequently they were most welcoming.
Coming across the telegraph line, our joy was unbounded. The horses seemed to get fresh energy at the sight of a beaten track. It is the road to Port Darwin too. We did scarcely anything but talk of getting some substantial food to eat. We were literally starving. After going a mile or so, we got to wooden telegraph posts and knew we were only 5 miles from the station.
The amazing buildings.
This is Powell Creek Telegraph Station, and it was on that veranda. I mentioned to you earlier that I walked along that veranda, and this is the building that she first felt that she was safe, that from here on in she was going to get to Port Darwin, but that was going to be quite easy compared to the challenges that she had already experienced on the road to this place. And it was here that she felt such a sense of relief and when I arrived at Power Creek Telegraph Station, I almost felt that sense of relief.
Would it have looked exactly the same to Emily?
Yeah, look, it's now classified as a heritage building, but there's nothing that has been done to it. In fact, if anything, over time it's run down, and it's the weather that's, I think that's, affected it.
This house is a good one, made strongly, with high walls and no windows. There are three rooms, a good size, in this building.
It is the exact building, and these doors here that we see in my sketches. I mean, we went into those rooms, and they are just little cement rooms with not a lot of, appointments. They're very, very primitive and very simple, but to her, I imagine it would have been like arriving at a palace.
They were delighted to see us. I am the first woman who has ever been here, and we are the only strange faces they have seen here for more than a year. We enjoyed our supper of cold shoulder of mutton, sardines, salmon, good yeast bread and jam, and tea with milk in it out of china cups.
The hard trip had come to an end, and she was now going to survive. Up to that point, there was some doubt about it. Powell Creek Station meant to her that the horses could drink and no longer had to be shot from lack of water.
Yes, they still had to get back. They still had to get to Port Darwin, but they knew that was nothing compared to what lay behind them.
The group followed the Overland Telegraph line for the final 600 miles to Darwin. After the expedition, Harry and Emily Caroline went to Sydney for the birth of their child, conceived during the trip. Harry's work soon took them back to the Northern Territory. 3 years later, just before the birth of their second son, Harry was tragically killed while breaking in a young horse. Caroline remained in Rockhampton, taking over the running of a guest house. She married Joseph Barnett in 1889. And went on to have another 6 children. The family lived on Marlborough Station in North Queensland, which was managed by Barnett. Emily remained an ardent churchgoer all her life, eventually returning to Sydney to live near the harbour. Emily Caroline Cray outlived all other members of the 1883 expedition, dying on Armistice Day 1944 at the age of 84.
We can read official accounts of exploration, but what is much rarer is this access to people who were involved further down the line. And I think it is useful to remind ourselves over a century later that there was this newness, this freshness. There was an Australia that wasn't marked by the European presence, and I think it gives us a better appreciation then of what has happened in the interim, how things have changed as a result of this contact.
It's her story that I'm telling, and I'm using paint and she's using words. Ultimately, for me, this has been a celebration of the Australian landscape, and at heart, I'm an Australian landscape painter, and she is an Australian woman exploring the Australian landscape.
I was only 8, and we were playing games, having a lovely time, and observing her. And I remember sitting down on the way to the ferry and watching this tired, upright woman stoically walking up the hill, step by step, and looking at us. We were two urchins on the side of the road, acknowledging us, and we acknowledged her, but she must have wondered, stoically walking up the hill, step by step by step.
In She Who Explores, you heard landscape artist Gemma Lynch Memory, historian Peter Monteith, and Emily Carolyn's great-granddaughter, Diana Smith. Readings from Emily Carolyn Cray's 1883 diary were read by Chantal Jamieson. The sound engineer was Judy Rapley, and She Who Explores was produced by Ros Bluett. For further reading and a glimpse at the beautiful artwork created by Gemma Lynch Memory, just head to our website. 40 years before Emily Cray ventured into the interior, in another part of colonial Australia, the fate of one European woman appeared to be pitted against the dangers inherent in a harsh and alien Australian landscape. In the mid-1840s, in the ragtag settlement that had been developed around Port Phillip in Victoria, a story spread among the European settlers, a tale which very soon had taken on a life of its own. It told of a white woman, supposedly a survivor of a shipwreck, who'd been kidnapped by the Aboriginal tribes of Gippsland. And yet, despite reports of several sightings and over a year or more several search parties, no woman was ever found. So, did the captive white woman ever exist, or was she a manifestation, an embodiment of the European experience on the Australian frontier?
In the evening, I ascended a hill near the camp, from the top of which I obtained a good view of the low country still before us, of the high mountains and the lakes. And from the general view of the country as I then stood, it put me more in mind of the scenery of Scotland than any other country I had hitherto seen. And therefore I named it at that moment Caledonia Australis.
Well, this is a fascinating story, and it begins at one of the earliest moments when white settlers were coming into Gippsland. And Angus McMillan had arrived shortly before. He'd travelled overland from the Monaro Plains area of New South Wales to take up stations on behalf of his employer, McAllister. And he was out exploring with a small party, and he describes how his party came upon an Aboriginal encampment. And on their arrival, the Aborigines all ran away. And when McMillan and his party searched the campsite, they found a large amount of European items and clothing. Such an extensive amount of European items and clothing that it conjured up a whole community. There were
several pieces of women's
garments,
wearing
women's apparel, garments, children's
namely
clothing,
prints and merinos, one German frock, two pea jackets, new brown Macintosh cloak, also stained with blood, a large lock of brown hair, evidently that of a European woman, one child's white frock with brown velvet band, one woman's thimble, two large parcels of silk sewing thread, various colours, 10 new English blankets, perfectly clean,
perfectly white.
We observed the men with spears, driving before them the women, one of whom we noticed constantly looking behind her, at us, on examining the marks and figures about the largest of the native huts. We were immediately impressed with the belief that the unfortunate female is a European, a captive of these ruthless savages.
The woman was supposed to have been a shipwreck survivor. Now, the idea of this sole survivor, invested with all of the hopes of this new immigrant community, was one that appealed to the imagination of the people who read this account. I mean, I guess many of them would have had friends and family themselves who'd been shipwrecked. And so this story brought home to them, I think, the dangers of being a new immigrant community in a new country, the dangers of actually travelling there, the dangers once they arrived.
One blue silk
an article of female
with brown velvet band.
Apart from the original Macmillan list of things he'd found, which may have been the result of a shipwreck or something, I never saw any evidence that such a person really existed. But I mean, it's a classic myth. You know, you can't prove it one way or the other.
Awed to the white woman. Unhappiest of the fairer kind, who knows the misery of thy mind, what tongue thy grief can tell? Torn from kind parents, friends, and home, and left in the wild woods to roam.
I had no idea. None of my family had ever heard of the white woman of Gippsland. They were in Gippsland from about 1850, so it was never passed on. And I got the idea to write a book about the frontier in Gippsland, I think at my grandmother's funeral. And it was a very short time between starting and finding the story of the white woman. And I guess the other thing was that she fitted with the tale as far as I was concerned, because Angus McMillan was such a sad sort of a character in a way. He came from a family, as far as I can tell, were really just perennial factotums. I mean, they were to do the work of other greater men. And that was a traditional role in Highland society, and it was, in a way, adapted for the empire. But he seems to have left behind a woman, his dear Margaret, that he wrote about. And it's hard to, reading the scraps of his diary, you think, well, was it a real romance, or was it... Sometimes people, you get the feeling, write as if something real is happening to them in these extreme situations, like alone sailing across the world in a sailing ship. But let us assume that Margaret existed, or someone whom he loved, or someone in his mind. The moment you came across the white woman, you immediately think, this woman just might be a kind of fantasy.
This day we were met by a tribe of the wild blacks, who came up quite close to us and stared at us while we were on horseback. But the moment I dismounted, they commenced yelling and took to their heels, running away as fast as possible. And from the astonishment displayed at the circumstance of my dismounting from the horse, I fancied they took both man and horse to be one animal.
There's many stories. The one that comes to mind the most is the so-called Kapura, and kept as a prisoner was a non-Indigenous woman. We believe it was used as a means to carry out massacres of our people in our country, which they did, right? And that was the Scottish Brigade of East Gippsland.
Is there any story at all in Gunai oral tradition or memory of perhaps a white woman having been taken?
I can't remember any of my old people of this country ever talking about a woman as captured by our people. You know, to me it was a mission created by non-Indigenous people and for that purpose. It was an excuse, in my honest opinion, to devastating work that they carried out in the massacres.
Overall, the evidence all suggests they were utterly ruthless in the way they treated them. You know, McMillan later talked about how they would never make friends. You know, we were trying to be friendly with the Aborigines. Well, they'd just taken their land off them. And when they played up, they routed them.
You've been listening to an excerpt from the feature Loantooka, the Captive White Woman of Gippsland. Speakers included the historians Don Watson and Kate Darien-Smith, Gunai Elder, Albert Mullish and Julie Carr. Readings were by the late Frank Gallagher and David Tredinnick. And that's Hindsight for today. Look forward to your company again next week when we bring you a feature set in the Amazon jungle and the quest for lost cities of gold.
Hello, Richard Ady here. Have you ever taken part in an online discussion forum? What did you say? Because it may turn out to be more important than you think. Information about you, some of which could well be wrong, is collected and stored on the internet, and it's there forever. Your reputation ain't what it used to be. You can find out more by listening to our talkback on this very issue on the Life Matters website.